sabotage and strategic attacks. It used to be in the old days that it was clear when you're gathering intelligence information, you know, you're using human agents or you're taking photographs from satellites or airplanes or you're eavesdropping on phone calls of various kinds. The person who was on the other end of those intelligence collection efforts knew that that was intelligence collection.
We have 5 seconds. More.
Okay. Today, if you intrude on someone's computer network, you can not only gather information, but you can destroy that network. You can sabotage it. And when you think about all the things that are connected to the internet, that becomes very dangerous in a crisis.
We have to leave it there. George Beebe of the Quincy Institute and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 39th Annual Ceramic Showcase and Gathering of the Guilds on Friday, May 6th through Sunday, May 8th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. The Ceramic Showcase features gallery exhibits, artist booths, and clay demonstrations. Again, that's the 39th Annual Ceramic Showcase and Gathering of the Guilds on Friday, May 6th through Sunday, May 8th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. A leaked Supreme Court draft opinion indicates the High Court seems set to overturn Roe v. Wade. A synagogue in Northwest Portland is vandalized in an anti-Semitic attack. And in international news, civilians are successfully evacuated from Mariupol in Ukraine as the city is almost entirely under Russian control. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 3rd, 2022. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. According to a leaked draft opinion published by Politico on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court seems set to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark case that has made abortion legal nationwide for nearly 50 years. The information comes from an initial draft majority opinion written by conservative Justice Samuel Alito, circulated inside the court. Politico said it received a copy of the draft opinion from a person familiar with the court's proceedings in the Mississippi case, along with other details supporting the authenticity of the document. Chief Justice John Roberts confirmed Tuesday that the draft was authentic and called the leak an egregious breach of the court's trust. The court stressed that the draft did not represent the final opinion of any member or the full court. No draft decision in the modern history of the court has been leaked to the public while a case was still pending. Chief Justice Roberts said that he has directed the marshal of the court to investigate where the unprecedented leak came from. While the draft, which is from February, is subject to change before the court issues a final opinion, the potential decision has reignited the debate over abortion rights. Roe v. Wade and a subsequent 1992 decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion rights. The leak is a first draft of the majority opinion planning to rule in favor of Mississippi in the closely watched case over the state's attempt to ban most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Overall, the draft is highly critical of Roe v. Wade and makes several key points as to why the majority of justices would back overruling the decision. The immediate impact of the ruling would be to end federal constitutional protection of abortion rights and allow each state to decide whether to restrict or ban the procedure. If the 1973 ruling is overturned, almost two dozen states are already poised to ban or severely restrict abortion access. 13 states have so-called trigger laws, or bans on abortion that will go into effect if Roe is struck down. Only 11 states, including Oregon, have laws specifically protecting abortion rights. Four of the other Republican-appointed justices, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, had voted with Alito in the conference held among the justices after hearing oral arguments in December. The three Democratic-appointed justices, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, are working on one or more dissents. How Chief Justice Roberts will ultimately vote and whether he will join an already written opinion or draft his own is unclear. Protesters gathered outside the Supreme Court on Monday night chanting, quote, abortion is health care. Some carried signs with slogans like legal abortion once and for all and we won't go back. President Joe Biden issued a statement Tuesday saying, quote, a woman's right to choose is fundamental, end quote. Biden said rights like the right to privacy and the right to marriage may also come under fire based on the precedent. The Biden administration said they will be ready when any ruling is issued. The report sparked reactions from lawmakers on both sides of the issue, as well as advocacy groups like Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union, who slammed the apparent draft. A final opinion from the High Court is not expected until late June or early July. Staff members at Congregation Beth Israel in Northwest Portland discovered Monday morning that someone had vandalized the synagogue with threatening hate speech and fire. Someone used yellow paint to write on the synagogue wall, quote, Die Juden. Juden is the German word for Jews. There were also burn marks on a synagogue door. Senior Rabbi Michael Kahana said, quote, the hatred, the bigotry, is still alive and it's still a part of our community, end quote. Kahana believes the yellow paint was used as a reference to the yellow star badges that Nazis forced Jews to wear during the Holocaust. He also believes the timing of the vandalism is significant, since Wednesday was Holocaust Remembrance Day. The synagogue reported the threat to the police and also notified the FBI and the Anti-Defamation League. Last year, the Anti-Defamation League tracked more than 2,700 anti-Semitic incidents nationwide, the most on record since they started tracking them in 1979, and a 34% increase from 2020. Kahana said he wanted to expose what happened, not hide it from the public, adding, quote, we have a right to assemble. We have a right to be in our synagogue. We have a right to be in our sacred space. No one's going to keep us from that, end quote. The first civilians fleeing the besieged steel plant in the southeastern port city of Mariupol in Ukraine have reached relative safety in another Ukrainian city. The successful evacuation follows weeks of failed efforts to help those trapped in the city, which is now almost entirely under Russian control. Even with Russia's invasion struggling to make progress, officials have warned that Moscow will try to annex large parts of eastern Ukraine as soon as this month, as it seeks to bring parts of the country under Kremlin control for the long term. President Joe Biden visited an Alabama Lockheed Martin facility on Tuesday that makes Javelin weapons. The U.S. has donated more than 5,500 javelins to Ukraine since the Russian invasion began. The Javelin is known as the tank killer because its top attack capability means it pops up into the air before diving down and targeting the top of tanks, where the armor is the thinnest. Biden's visit comes as the Pentagon and Congress are discussing the long-term impact for the U.S. of giving so many of these and other weapons to Ukraine so quickly. The administration's supplemental budget request includes $550 million to establish a critical munitions acquisition fund. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the fund would allow the Pentagon to, quote, purchase and establish a strategic reserve of vital munitions like anti-aircraft and anti-tank munitions, and then to surge for this crisis, and quite frankly, crises to come, end quote. The United Nations said Tuesday that it has recorded the deaths of more than 3,000 Ukrainian civilians since the beginning of Russia's invasion in February. Officials stressed that the true figure is likely to be considerably higher. on the heels of last week's human rights report on the Minneapolis Police Department, reform advocates are pressing ahead with calls for improvements locally and around the state. No matter where changes can be made, some say everyone should recognize the report's findings and the pain associated with them. Mike Moen has more on the story.
As the Minnesota legislature considers new police reform proposals, the discussions coincide with results from a state investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. Groups pushing for change say a meaningful response is needed. Last week, Minnesota's Human Rights Department announced Minneapolis police have engaged in a pattern of race discrimination that violates state statute. The probe started right after the murder of George Floyd. Jonathan McClellan of the Minnesota Justice Coalition says his group isn't anti-police, but he hopes the findings convince those who are skeptical of reform to reconsider their stance.
If the protests weren't enough for you, if the death of George Floyd and Dante Wright or Winston Smith wasn't enough for you, we hope that the report is enough for you to at least look at this.
His group backs legislation that sets deadlines for police to release body camera footage. Another plan would extend the civil statute of limitations in deadly force cases. Those are part of a larger House public safety plan. However, Senate leaders have emphasized other public safety priorities, including police officer recruitment. In Minneapolis, accountability groups say community voices should be included as the state works with the city on a consent decree to establish changes. For Minnesotans elsewhere, McClellan says he hopes the report resonates with them, even if they haven't been victimized by police.
This should have us all question what we believe and what our role is in a society and as a people.
The Minnesota Justice Coalition has asked federal officials for investigations into the practices of other agencies, including the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The group suspects questionable methods have carried over into other jurisdictions, but no decision has been made to authorize those probes. Separately, the U.S. Justice Department continues its own review of MPD in the wake of George Floyd's murder. I'm Mike Mullen reporting.
Senator Chuck Schumer slams anti-Semitic remarks from Russia's foreign minister. High-profile endorsements surround Ohio's primary election. And the Biden administration defends a new disinformation board. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Sickening. It is sickening. Mr. Lavrov's comments are just sickening and deserve to be condemned by all who oppose the dangers of anti-Semitism.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the most senior elected Jewish official in U.S. history, denounced Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's claim that Hitler had Jewish blood, referring to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's Jewish origins. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the U.S. will continue working to strengthen NATO as she led a delegation of lawmakers to Poland after visiting Ukraine. The group held an enrollment ceremony for a land lease bill, which Chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee Gregory Meeks says is a crucial tool.
The Ukrainian people are on the battlefield, fighting for their democracy, fighting for their sovereignty, and fighting for the rest of the world, so that we can preserve democracies everywhere.
In election news, Indiana and Ohio kick off a series of congressional primaries today, determining contenders for fall races to decide control of the House and Senate. The Republican Senate primary in Ohio is drawing special attention. Jacob Rubashkin, a reporter and analyst with Inside Elections, explains former President Donald Trump held a grip over the field of eight candidates,
making all the candidates come down to Mar-a-Lago and really relishing in the fact that almost all of these candidates, with, of course, the exception of Matt Dolan, are going above and beyond to try and win his endorsement because the former president is still the most influential figure in the Republican Party.
Trump endorsed J.D. Vance, an author and political newcomer. Vance had been neck and neck with former state treasurer Josh Mandel, who is backed by Texas Republican U.S. Senator Ted Cruz and retired General Michael Flynn. Vance holds a slight edge in polling. In Indiana, five Republicans are running for a chance to go against freshman Democratic Congressman Frank Mervin. Just two, Jennifer Ruth Green and Blair Milo, who are both veterans, have raised money. However, Mervin has raised much more than both and won the 2020 election by 16 points. The U.S. House January 6th committee is requesting information from Republican Congressman Andy Biggs of Arizona, Mo Brooks of Alabama, and Ronnie Jackson of Texas. The panel is probing whether any of the men were involved in White House discussions regarding attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki fielded reporter questions Monday about the Department of Homeland Security's newly convened board on disinformation.
The mandate is not to adjudicate what is true or false online or otherwise. It will operate in a nonpartisan and apolitical manner. It's basically meant to coordinate a lot of the ongoing work that is happening.
She said the goal is to address disinformation related to threats such as violent extremism, human trafficking, and malign foreign influence. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kabu.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 72 degrees. Today in history, in 1947, Japan's post-war constitution goes into effect. The Progressive Constitution granted universal suffrage, stripped Emperor Hirohito of all but symbolic power, stipulated a Bill of Rights, abolished peerage, and outlawed Japan's right to make war. The quote of the day is from American diplomat, politician, and lawyer Carol Moseley Braun, who said, quote, "Defining myself, as opposed to being defined by others, is one of the most difficult challenges I face," end quote. The Yurok tribe is releasing condors in Northern California's redwoods. A New Mexico task force is holding an event on the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous People. And tribal leaders and lawmakers in California will discuss violence against Native Americans. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Yurok tribe, in collaboration with national and state parks, are releasing two condors Tuesday in Northern California's redwoods. They'll be the first to take flight in the region since the late 1800s. The effort has been underway by the tribe since 2008. For the tribe, the recovery of the species is part of restoration of the ecosystem and also for the people responsible for taking care of it. The condor plays a principal role in the tribe's creation story and featured in cultural dances. Tribal Wildlife Director Tiana Williams-Clausen, in a video message, shares the importance of the restoration for future generations, including for her young daughter.
She's going to grow up having condors in her sky for her entire life. She's not even going to know what it is to miss condors. She will always live in relationship with condors, which is really what this whole program is all about, bringing condor home, back into our communities, back into our conversations, back into our households and into the minds and hearts of our children, on behalf of the hearts of our elders.
The condors are voluntarily entering a designated staging area with access to the outside world. If the birds do not enter the transition zone by late afternoon, a second attempt to release the birds will occur Wednesday. The carefully designed release procedure is part of the management plan for the reintroduction. Two more condors will be released at a later date. The New Mexico Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force is holding an event on Thursday. May 5th is recognized across the country as National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous People. The group has been meeting virtually due to COVID-19 precautions. Thursday's event will take place in person in Albuquerque. Members of the task force will discuss their response plan for the state. Cabinet Secretary of Indian Affairs Lynn Trujillo talked about the awareness event during a task force meeting in April.
To listen to our communities, to reflect on our work and accomplishments and celebrate that, and then continue to look forward and think about what's next for all of us. The staff has also been working through many of our phenomenal partnerships One with the Second Judicial Attorney General's office. They have been reaching out and meeting with some of our tribal leadership. The UNO research team, the FBI, and other community organizations to start working towards those solutions that we have laid out in the state response plan.
The task force was established in 2019 to address issues involving missing and murdered Indigenous people. Members of the task force have since released findings and recommendations to the state's governor and lawmakers. In California, Wednesday, at the state capitol in Sacramento, tribal leaders, lawmakers, and the State Department of Justice will discuss violence against Native Americans. They'll take part in a press conference and legislative hearing to share what actions are being taken to reduce and solve violence against California Native Americans, particularly women and girls. Assembly members James Ramos, chair of the Assembly Select Committee on Native American Affairs, and Christina Garcia will host the news event in the morning on Capitol steps. Later in the day, the two lawmakers will chair a joint informational hearing on the issue. The hearing is expected to include testimony from law enforcement, tribal leaders, and advocates. The Navajo Police Department on Monday received Amber Alert toolkits to aid in response when a person goes missing. The Amber Alert and Indian Country Initiative donated 7 Amber Alert kits to the Navajo Nation. They include a tablet, headset, webcam, scanner, and camera. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Indigenous farmers are bringing back crops adapted to hot and dry conditions. The AHO Center for Sustainable Agriculture in Arizona offers training and seeds to help native growers adapt to the extremes of climate change. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms and the threat of water scarcity grows, a native-governed nonprofit in Arizona is working to bring back indigenous crops that are adapted to hot, dry conditions. The AHO Center for Sustainable Agriculture trains indigenous growers in traditional farming methods, and it shares seeds for a range of crops, including drought-tolerant varieties of squash, beans, and corn.
I have watched our apprentices growing them and appreciating them and growing them for their families, and taking that knowledge that they learned from me as an apprentice to share to their kids.
Sterling Johnson is the group's farm manager and a member of the Tana Autumn Nation. For him, reclaiming native farming practices is not only about building a more climate-resilient food system. It's a way to recover elements of native culture that the U.S. government attempted to suppress or destroy through many years of forced assimilation.
For hundreds of years, we fought hard and still fighting to this day to reclaim things that were ours to begin with, because these seeds are important.
So he hopes that reviving and passing down indigenous farming knowledge will help his community thrive. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
For nearly 2 years, China's daily COVID caseload rarely extended into triple digits, and often weeks went by without a single case. All that changed in March as multiple outbreaks across the country saw the largest surge in China's local infections since it brought its initial outbreak in Wuhan under control in early 2020. For the ruling Communist Party, which has sought to promote its ability to control the virus as evidence for its superior model of governance, the outbreak represents a significant political challenge. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
We're all aware how much Joe Biden has on his plate in this election year. But we should pause to consider how much is on the plate of China's Xi Jinping. Chinese leaders like to crow about the country's stability and prosperity, a model, supposedly, for other countries with strong-armed leadership. But the reality is different. Widespread repression of ethnic minorities, regime critics, and Hong Kong pro-democracy forces, rising inequality between rich and poor, a war in Ukraine that is slowing the economy, and the resurfacing of COVID, which the regime had declared vanquished in 2020. These problems, and especially the threat posed by the Omicron variant, come at the worst possible moment for Xi, who is expected to be chosen for third term as president and party leader later this year. Why has China failed to contain Omicron, which has rapidly spread from Hong Kong to Shanghai, Beijing, and about 40 other cities? The short answer is that China never developed a vaccine as effective as the vaccines in use in the US, Europe, and elsewhere, and never vaccinated enough elderly people. Then the Chinese leadership responded to the new outbreak with a zero COVID policy that has proven unworkable. Yet overzealous Communist Party leaders seem unwilling to abandon the policy. The result is rising public anger as lockdowns and mass testing once again are being imposed. Let's recall the contrast between what is happening now in China compared with the country's earlier success at dealing with the pandemic. That success did not come easily. When the pandemic broke out in Wuhan late in 2019, the Chinese leadership sat on awareness of its lethality weeks before it reported to the World Health Organization, WHO, that it was dealing with a highly contagious disease, and several more weeks before Beijing said the coronavirus could be passed between humans. When the leadership did act, it acted decisively, trying to make the public forget the cover-up and instead see victory over COVID as a matter of national pride. While the Trump administration engaged in its own cover-up, using China as a foil, remember his taunts about a Chinese virus? China took the opposite tack. It not only instituted a mass quarantine, it donated over $2 billion to the WHO, promised Africa debt relief, and sent vaccine aid to a number of developing countries. But what China did not do bears analysis. It refused to submit to an impartial, independent, and comprehensive evaluation of the origins of COVID, even though it had voted for the WHO resolution that called for it. It pushed the not very credible hypothesis that some non-Chinese source, such as in Europe, or imported food, or a leak from a U.S. military research facility was to blame. It defied the criticisms of numerous epidemiologists outside China who urged that China accept a, quote, comprehensive, science-based, and data-driven investigation of COVID-19's origins, as one such group urged. China's refusal to allow an outside investigation left open the possibility that top Chinese officials knew the origin of COVID all along, namely that it was the result of a lab leak or bat-to-human transmission. Keeping a lid on information in order to maintain social stability is a cornerstone of Xi Jinping's leadership. Information is a tool of authority, but it is also its enemy. These days, many Chinese, recalling the suppression of information in Wuhan, are angry about the disjuncture between the government's claims and the reality of their daily lives. As a New York Times reporter writes, government propaganda isn't working as well as it once did. Quote, officials have responded with their usual playbook, censoring critical posts, inundating state media with positive stories, and blaming foreign forces for fanning false ones. But far from stemming the anger, they have fueled it. Residents have compiled footage from their daily lives, showing rotting food or shouting matches with local officials, rebutting the authorities' story of a tidy, cheery outbreak response. They have banded together to repost deleted content with a speed and savvy that for a time overwhelmed censors' ability to keep up. Even some members of the political and academic elite have suggested that the government's propaganda about Shanghai is hurting its credibility. An official banner in Shanghai urges people to obey orders. Persistence is victory, it says. But if the government persists in keeping people cooped up, Mr. Xi will be facing much more widespread dissension than he faces now. Mass dissent is highly risky in China, but the people have a weapon they never used to have, social media. And you have to look far and wide to find the Chinese who doesn't have internet access and a smartphone. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 3rd, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, it's Fight the Empire. Post-Parafaggering connects history with the latest world events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact, the magic of childbirth. Through the work and birth stories of midwife Allegra Hill, the producers of Rework Radio explain how Black midwives in Los Angeles are helping women to experience empowered births.
From the UCLA Labor Center, we bring you Rework. I'm Saba Wahid.
And I'm Veena Humpapour.
Each birth is a miracle, and I am fortunate to get to experience that miracle so many times. Birth continues to affect my life in the most wonderful way because it helps me stay in gratitude and stay present and experience the magic that is the introduction of a new person on the planet.
There's such a veiling around birth and labor, and how much people know or understand. There's almost like a mystery around it.
I feel like there's so much we miss in terms of the work women do. Emotional labor, having a child. It's literally called labor, right? Like, women are putting a lot into carrying and having and caring for a baby. These are things that are so invisible in the world. One thing that's really beautiful in this story is the ties between women and the ties between generations.